Blog Talk Radio.
Africa, the center of the world. Latitude zero, longitude zero, planned by the Creator. Sizanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa. So vast, so great, the African embrace, the color of life. Universal harmony. The earth supports our conscious effort for sustained humanity. Human beings. Human love. On a spiritual tip. So vast. So great. The African embrace. Live beyond. Love beyond your skin to where you belong.
Started a long time ago, and it wasn't a show. We gave birth to a style like a precocious child, feeling the passion for life, erasing away all the strife, telling our tales with verbal mail, putting honey on the blade, creating language to persuade. you've always been. Always a blessing, never a sin. We are doo-wop and bebop and hip-hop and we don't stop. Since our mother gave birth to everyone on earth, should we echo her call? And always walk tall. Cause we're hip to the world, so we create black pearls. That everyone can wear, that everyone can share. We can't live in despair, so we shine everywhere. On and on. On and on. On and on.
We welcome you to Africa on the Move. As your host, Brother Africa, it's always an honor and privilege to come to your homes this evening, where we can speak to the powerless and the powerful. Today, on the 5th day of September 2021, our theme tonight is a continuation of part 3, dealing with deception, control, and power. We welcome you to join us by calling in at 323-679-0841. And our agenda tonight will entail what's going on in your world and community, followed by a discussion on the theme from various articles and documentaries that will reflect our concept tonight. We'd like to hear your views and your perspectives as well, again, by joining us. But like always, I'm your host, Brother Africa, and we in the seat, we're going to take the heat. As we define it, we're going to stand behind it. And like I said earlier, as always, the way we start our party is to introduce to you our political panelists and analysts for today's program. Right now, we have Brother Haki, and we're going to bring Brother Haki in, and we would like to welcome him to Africa on the Move. Welcome, Brother Haki.
Brother Africa, good to be here. My name is Haki Tamatha Mishoke, Colonel with African Awareness, and of course, my thing is institution building. But before I even get to the question of institution building, you know, in the context of North America, one of the things I got to say, Brother Africa, I'm somewhat disappointed in terms of the transformation that's been occurring in Azania, South Africa, given the kind of struggles that are taking place. I was a bit more optimistic that they will follow the line of Mandela and proceed to change the paradigm the country was facing, and in changing that paradigm, create a new way in terms of moving forward. But that hasn't been the case. In any event, I think there's some history. I think it's important that people understand in terms of essentially what's happening in South Africa. Now, check this out, Brother Africa. Now, transformation of Africa's economies are complicated by opposing philosophies espousing the best avenue to develop an economy. On the one hand, transformation of African economies is best achieved by nationalizing their economy, making economic decisions a distinct part of institutional mandates, thereby elevating the realization of economic power. Contravailing economic views maintain macroeconomic development or the growth of corporate earnings should take precedent over the distribution of wealth. Under this scenario, foreign investments hold the key to economic growth. This view espouses the idea without economic growth, redistribution of wealth is not possible. This philosophy at its core is fallacious and often used to obscure the corruption and manipulation associated with macroeconomic financing. Now, on a side note, Brother Africa, if I'm allowed to transgress, it is important to point out Western investments and the role they play in introducing technology and farming practices that adversely impact the ecosystem in South Africa and Africa generally. Industrial agriculture is implicated in fostering food or poor nutritional value while driving up the cost of food. While 42% of the population live on $5 a day, the lack of access to food and the poor nutritional value of the food imperils the immune system of many South Africans, making many South Africans vulnerable to a myriad of infections. For the multinational corporation, it's business as usual. Now, in the case of South Africa, all the variables affiliated with profitable trade exist. South Africa has a diversified and productive and advanced economy, abundant natural resources, a transparent legal system, and a relative political stability. Despite these attributes of South Africa, the World Bank's rates South Africa 84 out of 190 economies in the world to invest in. According to the World Bank, high crime rates, social unrest, strikes, and demonstrations, high levels of corruption, electrical power grid issues, and possible structural reform imposing increased taxes on foreign corporations are some of the reasons why. Based upon this criteria, why would anyone invest in the U.S.? Obviously, with respect to investments in South Africa, a hidden motive is at play, whereby the motives of foreign capital seek not just to maximize profits by labeling South Africa a risky investment, but perhaps to inhibit South Africa's economic growth. There is no question obstacles are erected essentially to derail South Africa's economic growth. Policies of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank exist specifically to plunder the resources of Africa, and South Africa is no exception. However, I would be remiss by not pointing out the misdeeds of South African politicians who enhance their wealth at the expense of the people by utilizing former economic colonial structures erected by their predecessors. By refusing to eradicate or at the very least to reform these institutions, political heads of the government in South Africa inadvertently give legitimacy to structures designed specifically to maximize profits for the minority while inflicting hardship on the majority. A point highly debated during the Freedom Charter of 19, the ruling party, the ANC, chose to proceed with politics that elevated foreign investments as a panacea. Of course, this position is consistent with the class analysis, but what it did not take into consideration was the level of historical deprivation among the population and a lack of access to education. Given this reality, the basic needs of the people should have been incorporated in political strategy where the wealth of the country would be used to address the people's needs. Implicit in this idea is the notion that that the wealthy would have access to less wealth and any foreign investments would be targeted toward increases in social and community service spending. As it currently stands, a majority of foreign investments in South Africa goes to finance, insurance, real estate, and the manufacturing sectors. While these investments enrich the Gupta brothers and others' entrenched interests, the human capital needed to ensure a viable nation remains neglected. Any notion that economic growth could lead to radical distribution of wealth is clearly debunked. Instead, South Africa did experience growth, but the increase in growth pertained to the level of graft and corruption. Now, starting with President Thabo Mbeki in the late 90s, corruption gained precedent. Involved in questionable weapon sales, Mbeki would often utilize scapegoating to conceal his duplicity. Labeling Nigerians as drug dealers, he was able to divert attention from his corruption. Absolved by Jacob Zuma for corruption, a pre-pro quo was established. Free to engage in state capture or organized corruption among political class, Zuma was much more flamboyant. Providing security updates for his estate, these security measures included a swimming pool and an amphitheater for 246 million rand, or $23 million. The police minister assigned to investigate this unusual expenditure stated, quote, the pool is a fire prevention measure, end quote. I can only marvel at the investigator's creativity and use of language to defend the indefensible. The last time I heard anything compelling me to blurt out what the hell, former President Yahya Jammeh informed the people of the Gambia, quote, I can cure AIDS on Thursday, end quote. Zuma's antics did not end despite the obvious. He continued to facilitate state capture by appointing an obvious political hack who embraced corruption. Malusi Gigega, nicknamed the four-day special, was appointed finance minister. His appointment presumably was what the Gents article referred to as the final step in the consolidation of corruption among political elites. So when Beleke Mbete, former NANC chair, decries a popular legacy of corruption, she deflects from the corruption that currently exists that ever should affect South Africans today, which is facilitated by a party that said it is committed to change. Now, creativeness aside, the very real impact corruption negatively affects everyone, specifically the poor. International finance institutions do not have the vested interest in alleviating poverty in South Africa or anywhere else in the world for that matter. The road to salvation for South Africa lies in what Robert Sobukwe advocated decades ago. Quote, let me place with you, lovers of my Africa, to pair with you into the world the vision of a new Africa, end quote. Such a vision will never materialize until Pan-Africanism is achieved and the establishment of a paradigm that understands freedom should transcend economic class, and any system that proclaims class superior should infer the worst of repudiation. And I'll close with that, Brother Africa.
Thank you, Brother Haki. Next, we're going to Brother Moses. We bring in Brother Moses. Good evening to you, and welcome to Africa on the Move.
Thank you, Brother Africa, and greetings to everyone within the sound of my voice. My name is Robert Andrew Moses. I've been in this struggle for scientific socialism from the moment I was introduced to Marxism during a government class back in my high school years, 1968. I call Marxism the race to cure racism. I bear witness that there's one God, Jesus, who is the author and finisher of my faith, and that Mao Zedong is his messenger for government. Fathers, help your children. And we don't reverse correct verdicts. Brother Africa, I'm pro-choice, and I vote. And I'd like to say Equal Rights Amendment, ERA, yes. I think women hold up half the sky. And so, you know, the struggle is to unite the many, to defeat the lies of the few. Thank you, and look forward to the rest of the evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Moses. And to our listening audience, you're listening to Africa on the Move. They're in the seat, and they're going to take their heat. As they define it, they're going to stand behind it. What we're going to do right now, we're going to a rubber shirt culture break. And when we come back, we're going to get started on the segment, What's Going On in Your World and the Community. And we'd like to invite you to join us by dialing in at 1-323-679-0841. This is the voice of Africa on the Move. Brother Africa, we'll be right back. Don't you go nowhere.
Don't you where you come from? As long as you're a black man, you're an African. Don't mind your nationality, you have got the identity of an African. 'Cause if you come from Clarendon, and if you come from Portland, and if you come from Westmoreland, you're an African. So don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. No mind your nationality, have got the identity of an African. 'Cause if you come from Trinidad, and if you come from you
323-679-0841. You know, there are so many things going on in this world right now. So we're going to bring in our Brother Haki, and we're going to ask him, Brother Haki, kick the ballistics. What's going on in your world, in the community? The mic is now yours, Brother Haki.
Well, Brother Africa, I got to tell you, you know, we're quite aware of the role propaganda plays in terms of forming the confusion in the minds of many, many people. And we understand that people in positions of power was intentionally, they conscientiously created propaganda with the sole purpose in mind as to deceive people. In fact, it's very, very successful. And as a consequence, it disarms people, so people don't have an adequate understanding in terms of, you know, kind of changes that are taking place and the kind of repercussions of those changes. When we talk about the role in terms of telecommunications companies in terms of their ability to prop up a certain message, particularly prop up a conservative message at the expense of all other messages, then clearly we talk about the essence of which is we're at war. And so it's incumbent upon the people to understand, you know, that being in war, that information is extremely important in terms of being able to wage that war. Because without adequate information, it's very difficult, become very problematic in terms of waging war. And certainly one of the things that I find extremely problematic, Brother Africa, is in a lot of the environmental groups in terms of their propensity in terms of the play ball with corporate America at the expense of at the expense of humanity. And so I wrote this, and I think it sort of informs as to, you know, the real motivation behind environmental groups in terms of some of the shenanigans that take place in terms of their willingness to be part of the corporate agenda. So check this out, Brother Africa. Now, disinformation used by governments to deceive and distract the population from dire situations pertaining to explicit threats to the planet and on life has effectively infiltrated the thinking of countless millions and the organizations committed to disarming propaganda. Implicit in the thinking of the multitude is the notion industrial capitalism will save all and the inevitability of the corporate state a given. This kind of thinking has pernicious implications for individuals who are problematic, for environmental groups who embrace these perceptions, act on them, and disseminate information designed to deceive the public. Often this embrace of the corporate agenda by environmental organizations is preceded by corporate funding, providing a huge enough largesse where corporate agenda holds sway. Organizations like the Environmental Defense Fund, World Wildlife Fund, Greenpeace, and the Sierra Club all at some point have been beneficiaries of corporate largesse. Consequently, the advocacy emanating from these groups have been less than stellar. Distortions and outright lies that corporations have been allowed to stand with little or no pushback for environmental groups. One of the biggest deceptions peddled by corporations is the blurring of energy versus electricity. Now, according to Leah Keith, an environmentalist, claims of renewable energy normally applies to electricity, not the fossil fuels used to manufacture electricity. So when TV ads promised New York will implement 100% renewable energy by 2026, they are not advocating reduction in oil, gas extraction, or industrial process used to extract them. They are actually talking about increases in electricity, which currently consists of about 20% of all energy use. What they attempt to conceal is those gases will contribute to global warming, carbon, methane, et cetera. Production schedules will not decrease because a reduction in greenhouse gases will mean a reduction in productivity or profits. One could argue the invisible hand of capitalism does not want the people to understand profits are more important than life or the planet. Unfortunately, this propensity to elevate money over life does resonate among some segments of society. In the case of Roberto Cingolani, Italy's ecological transition minister, he is adamant the real problem with global warming is environmental extremists, not the industrial processes that created greenhouse gases. Cingolani's invective toward environmentalism is by no means an individualist impulse, but the culmination of capitalist programming that relegates materialism above all other concerns. In Lewis Mumford's Mega Machine Analysis, the theme of human serving machines rather than machines serving humans is a consistent tenet of society. The machine, in this case corporations' interests, supersede all other interests, human interests included. Corporate domination demands subservience among the population, and that subservience can best be obtained by technological innovation, which overwhelms human senses, whereby a sense of powerlessness is established among the people. Once people are relegated unimportant, social relations among people that make up social systems are destroyed, leaving corporations free to organize the world's resources in a manner most lucrative for corporations. Destruction of planet and of life becomes inconsequential because economic growth takes precedent over all other concerns. A disenfranchised social system ensures beneficiaries of the corporate agenda enjoy short-term benefits of growth, unaware or unconcerned about impending economic doom. It must be pointed out, technology will not solve global warming. Scientists state current global temperatures is about 1.2 degrees Celsius or 34.16 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. According to most scientists, global temperature rise of 1.5 degrees Celsius or 34.7 degrees Fahrenheit will render the Earth uninhabitable. Impacts of global warming currently is evident. According to an Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, 87% of wetlands vital to prevention of floods have been destroyed. Droughts are commonplace, with western states in the U.S. experiencing water difficulty as the Colorado River dries up. Over seven states, 40 million people depend on the Distress River for water. Both the Arctic and Greenland ice sheets are melting, and when they are gone, will result in seven meter sea level rise and showing an evacuation of coastal towns throughout the planet. In addition, absence of the ice sheets will not only ensure the exponential increase of temperatures on the planet, but alter ocean currents affecting nations' climates. This phenomenon currently exists, but will increase considerably when the ice shelves are totally melted. Putting global warming into context, I should point out the total elimination of fossil fuels may be unrealistic. Leah Keith rightly points out the density level of energy sources vary, where normally the higher the density, the more energy that can be extracted. For example, she conveyed the differences in energy output by comparing lithium batteries to diesel fuel. Lithium batteries, according to Ms. Keith, provides 1 joule of energy, While diesel fuel provides 46 joules of energy, the commercial implications are clear. The solution to global warming is to end large-scale mining projects, minimizing extraction, and limiting industrial farming that destroy wetlands and contributes to deforestation. What the planet does not need is policy that contributes to global warming. For example, the U.S. Congress recently passed the Growing Climate Solutions Act, which seeks to merely inform farmers about carbon capture technologies and other technologies to combat carbon emissions. The only problem with carbon capture is twofold. One, it does not address the carbon that currently exists in the atmosphere. And secondly, carbon capture, when exposed to pressures below 2,600 feet below the Earth, are susceptible to explosion or resulting tremors. What we need is an enlightenment exhibited by Extinction Rebellion and an end to capitalism and its indifference to life. Until we do that, Brother Let Africa, we're all simply in peril. So we got much work to do in terms of changing this paradigm if we are to save humanity and to save the planet.
Hey, nothing to it, Brother Haki, but just to get to it. So that's what we start working on. Let's do that. We thank you. Next, what's going on in your world and the community, Brother Moses? Kick some ballistics to our people.
Yeah, this has been a very interesting week. They tell me Andrea and Martin Luther King III sought voting rights and abolishing the filibuster in terms of the march that they had last Saturday. I think that I've had personal struggles this week where I feel like my feelings are being overlooked, and I'm trying to make an issue out of things. But I don't know if that's another, I guess that's just another time or the place. I don't have anything to say right now. I'm sorry. Thank you.
No problem, Brother Moses. Sometimes it's like that. We got our Sister Eleanor on the phone. We're going to bring her in. Sister Eleanor, welcome to Africa on the Moon. And what's going on in your world in the community, Sister Eleanor?
Oh, good evening, everyone, and to all the analysts and all our listeners. Thank you for allowing me to participate and tuning in. It's been an extraordinary week. I just wanted to comment on Brother Hakeem, and the issue of global warming is the most serious issue we're facing at hand, and it is going to require a complete restructuring of the economy and to take away the incentives for drilling for fossil fuel. Exxon and the big oil companies were just given permission to drill in Guyana. Now, I was concerned that China was building 20 coal plants, but here the United States is going to drill for oil. We have to stop using fossil fuels altogether. And there's a lot of science out here that has proven to be effective in reducing energy costs and producing quality industry level energy sources, such as solar energy, such as windmills, and other things. So we can use wind, we can use solar, geothermal. There are so many alternatives. And some of that requires that we deal with our own microenvironment. What we saw happen in Louisiana and come straight up the East Coast is a result of global warming. I don't think the sewers failed so much in New York City as the environment had. We don't get tornadoes on the East Coast. We don't have these type of heavy rains that we saw in this past week. This is a result of global warming. Consequently, people lost their lives. We need to pay attention to just how we manage litter, making sure that we don't, I see people often dropping things down the sewer on the sidewalk saying, oh, it's just going to go to the river. Well, that's exactly where it's going. And moreover, if it doesn't go there, it's going to clog the sewer system. And if there is a great rain, it's going to back up in our communities. So we need to do a great deal of community education. But most importantly, we need to see some legislative changes that will put an economic incentive for these capitalists to want to use alternative energy, to think of alternatives to fossil fuel, and we also need to make strong penalties where if they continue to use it and there's no cutting down or no making any attempt to address the issue, that they are fined, that they pay heavy fines for these things. We saw what happened with Jeff Bezos with the union. He got big fines for what he did, but it doesn't matter because it wasn't big enough. It's just the cost of doing business. So the courts identified that he broke labor laws all over the place. Amazon did, but it didn't matter in the long run because the few million dollars that he had to pay in legal fees and in fines were just a part of doing business. It was just a part of Amazon's doing business. So we need to restructure. And as Brother Hakeem said, we need to consider another economic structure, or at least taking out the economic incentive out of fossil fuel and from people who interfere with labor's right to organize. We have the least union members ever, I think, in American history at this time. And I don't think it's worker apathy. I think it's a majority of things. I think the bosses, the petty bosses, can buy off people on the line and that sort of thing. But in the long run, it holds back the masses. So the other issue was the issue in Afghanistan, and I'm very proud of the women and children of Afghanistan. The women in Afghanistan demonstrated 2 days in a row, and they endured being tear gassed and beaten by the Taliban trying to stand up for their rights. And I think they're doing a great job. You can't lay low now. They got involved the very week the Taliban took over. And I understand there's one state in Afghanistan that has not surrendered and continued to fight. So I got to say I stand in solidarity with the people of Afghanistan, and I hope that they will develop a sound working government soon. Now, the Taliban says that they establish a government, women cannot hold high positions of authority. And we saw this week where the Taliban was busy eliminating public art. They just literally painted over public art, and they were up to their old tricks from the 1990s, where they destroyed. It's just public contemporary art now. In 1996, they destroyed ancient ruins and things that were tens of thousands of years old, Buddhist statues and these things. They blew them up. So we want to urge the Taliban to get some help in developing skills to do cross communication with the people of Afghanistan, the Afghanistan government, and I hope that they would have some commitment to allowing people to speak freely without fear for their lives or bodily harm. And that's about it. And I just say the Cuban people are struggling, but they're moving forward. So long live the Cuban Revolution. And we keep on struggling. And I don't know what's happening in the U.S. Congress that we can't get two bills passed to protect the rights of voters in this country. I don't know where our Democratic government is standing that we would allow this ridiculous voter suppression in D.C., where voting works, where there are no problems. One of the councilwomen had brought up something she called that's called ranked choice voting. My feelings are strongly, Brother Africa and fellow analysts, if it's not broke, don't fix it. In the District of Columbia, as in many other cities such as Philadelphia and New York, you simply walk into the voting poll. You give them your name and address. They have you identify yourself in the large voter registration book. You sign your name there, and you're off to vote. We don't need to change that. We have no voter fraud in this country. There was apparently an audit in 2014, and of the whole nations, there were 34 cases that could have been questionable, 34 instances, not 34 polling sites, not 34 districts, but 34 instances where individual voters, it was questionable whether or not they should have voted at that time. I'd say congratulations to the American voters. Register to vote and keep it up. And urge Congress to pass the John Lewis Voters' Rights Bill and the second bill, which I'm sorry I don't know the full name of, but it's regularity in voting or something. But we need to have both pieces of legislation passed on the Hill so we can fight back in 18 states across the country what this Alexis is doing. So I just want to say thank you to everyone, and I'm so happy to be here. It's been challenging this week in terms of some health issues, but the fight goes on, and together with family and friends, and I'm doing great. Thank you.
Thank you, Sister Eleanor, to our listening audience. This is Africa on the Move. This is Brother Africa. And we're discussing what's going on in your world in the community. And we will continue the discussion when we come back from our rubber share culture break.
Buffalo. Dead like a rasta. It was a buffalo soldier in the heart of America, stolen from Africa, brought to America, fighting an arrival, fighting for survival. And he was taken from
Portugal. You're in a Milan. Dig out me gold in a Milan.
Digging out me pearl
in a Milan.
Dig out me diamond. We are gonna fight against the apartheid.
Against apartheid. We're not just talking about in Tanzania and South Africa. We talk wherever you find African people who are dispossessed, who don't control their land base and their resources and their labor. All of it, in essence, are the same. So right now, we're walking you back to Africa on the Move. We're in the seat. We take the heat. We're going to try to inspire you and elevate you to a higher level activity towards fighting for the liberation for Mother Africa, her people, and a better humanity for all man and womankind. So welcome back to the part three. The theme tonight is deception, control, and power. We'll be discussing this theme very shortly, but at this point in time, we'd like to continue our discussion on what's going on in your world and the community. Brother Haki, come and talk to me, Brother Haki. I want to raise a question with you, Brother Haki. There was a documentary we asked our panelists and analysts to take a look at from YouTube, where we're going to say the name of the documentary is Pop Avenue, Money, Power, and the American Dream. That's an interesting documentary. And one of the things what it does is really just shows you there are certain locations where the elite, among the elite, lives. And that's their base. That's their community. And when I was looking at the documentary, Brother Haki, I was just wondering that here they can display where the powerful the elite lives. And they seem to be living in a state of peace. There's no kind of opposition. They have, you know, no opposition in terms of them dealing with the consequences of the damaging, the lies, the destruction, the oppression that they are inflicting on people around the world, while they continue to live, you know, in a sense of normalcy. My question to you and the rest of the panelists, Brother Haki, is what can we do to make these oppressors realize that there will be no place on earth where they can live in peace until the people themselves have peace and justice? What you think about the role of Park Avenue and it plays toward displaying and organizing and carrying out different forms of oppression against people of the world? Your take, Brother Haki.
Well, you know, 740 Park Avenue is a very interesting place. You know, this particular building has more billionaires than any building, you know, in the country. And it's very, very interesting. But, you know, there is sporadic outcries in terms of the kind of fundamental injustices inflicted by these billionaires. There from time to time you have people who come out, you know, to picket those buildings. But unfortunately, it's a relatively small number of people. So, of course, the question is, how do we enlarge, how do we get more people to involve themselves in terms of, voicing their outrage in terms of the kind of systematic injustices fomented by these billionaires? That's going to take a lot of work, Brother Africa. It's, like I said before, the role of propaganda is a very, very intricate one. Its ability in terms of deceiving people, its ability to foment fear in people is very, very real. And so when you ask people to stand up, you're up against a situation where, you know, people are inculcated with all kinds of fears, all kinds of suspicions, all kinds of doubts. And so in that extent, propaganda is very, very effective. So against that backdrop, how do you overcome all of that is becomes a very intricate question. Of course, organization plays a part in terms of getting people to realize the power that they have. But of course, in terms of organizing folks, you got to first and foremost, you got to attract people. You got to get people to engage in these kind of discussions in order to move things forward. So it's a very, very long process. But to be more specific, I just want to make sure I pointed out that there are sporadic demonstrations of people actually coming out. But one of the things interesting about Brother Africa, when you talk about 740 Park Avenue, and keep in mind, people should understand that we only talk about only 31 units, and these people have very, very extremely large apartments. I mean, these apartments, a lot of them are the equivalent, you know, of a mansion. I mean, it's unbelievable. And so the people who live in these 31 units are largely people who represent the creme of the creme, you know, in the economic world here in America. And we talk about the hedge fund, you know, private equity firm directors and presidents and owners. So clearly, you know, the kind of wealth that these people hold, I mean, is tremendous. One other thing, Brother Africa, I want to say real quickly, you know, I think this is important that people get when we talk about 740 Park Avenue, is that when you walk down between the 60s and the 80s, whether on the east side, these are some of the most wealthiest people in the world. When you get to like 96th Street, then you begin to see the poverty. When you get up to 110th Street, you have immense poverty. So clearly, the kind of wealth is on display. So all the problems that are familiar with most of New York, it's not an issue as it pertains to these people. When you come out clean streets, making sure the city cleans up the streets, in terms, that's not an issue for these people. That's done. When it comes to collection of trash, it's not an issue. It's done. So all of these amenities that people take for granted are given when it comes to the wealthy. These amenities are not provided for people who are poor in New York, and the communities reflect that reality. But the bottom line, Brother Africa, I think that when you talk about in terms of engaging people, you know, to get them to take a stand in terms of actually confronting these people, getting them to understand the immense concern that people have with the kind of injustice in the society. In order to do that, we're going to have to have a mass organization. I mean, really have to have a mass organization. We got to be able not only to confront these people in terms of where they live, but actually be able to confront them in the Hamptons, at their mansions, or be able to confront them at the workplace. But it's going to take massive organization in terms of doing that. And with that massive organization comes, a tremendous amount of organization in terms of pulling it off. Because we got to understand, first and foremost, that when you talk about confronting these wealthy people, they, in fact, control the law enforcement apparatus in this country. And so when you come at them, and effectively what you're doing, you know, you're going to increase the amount of resistance among the law enforcement. And so therefore they're much more in a position, because they are beholden to the wealthy, they're much more in a position to fiercely defend the interests of the people who are very, very powerful and rich. So that's why the organization in the community organizing is so important, because you're not just confronting the wealthy, but you're confronting also all of those organizations, all those institutions that back up the wealthy. So you have to have that very strong organization. You have to have a community organization. You have to have a clear understanding in terms of what you're doing, because the bottom line is that when you take on these people, the reality is that, you know, there's a real likelihood that there can be some kind of repercussions when you do that. We have to be prepared for that, whether we're talking about losing your job or whether you're talking about being visited by the FBI or whatever. You got to be prepared for that. So we're going to take mass organization and tremendous understanding in terms of the situation we're up against, and understanding that the situation we're confronted with is dire. So if we don't do things, I mean, in a very striking fashion, the reality is that we simply won't be heard. So we need that mass organization in terms of empowering people to be bold enough to take those kind of positions that are needed in terms of confronting these people who are very, very powerful.
Okay, Sister Eleanor and Brother Moses, as we look at that documentary, they talk about a club that undermined this whole illusion of inclusion in terms of voting. They talk about this party that no one else really talk about is what they call the donor party. This donor party composed of about 200,000 people who basically select the politicians and determine who win and get these elections, who become president, and get many of these so-called official government jobs, irregardless of which party they belong to. What do you say about this issue? How should we deal with this donor party? How do we deal with this donor party in relationship and negating the reality that it became very clear when you watch this documentary that your vote means very little? I'll start with you, Brother Moses. Your take on the impact of the donor party and its contradiction against the whole concept of so-called voting participation. While we wait for Brother Moses, let's go to... Okay, go ahead, Brother Moses.
Yeah, I think, you know, the donor party represents a certain class of people, a certain strata, upper echelon of a class of people who have money, billions, and they, you use their money to carry out their interests, obviously. And, you know, we as a working class have to some point decide how they got their money and whether this is a just situation or not, and whether we should be appropriating some of that money for the good of the overall masses. And higher taxes is one way, but it comes down to the law and the government, the state. Somehow you have to take control of the state in order to get these laws passed, which which prevent this kind of inequity. And see, the point is not to understand the world. The point is to change the world, according to Marx. And so, we don't want to just become aware of the problem, but we want to figure out a solution to the problem. And that's where we need a political party and conscious people to take action. Thank you. I'll leave it right there.
Thank you, Brother Moses. Mr. Eleanor, your response. How do you deal with this issue of this donor party versus the so-called illusion of the power to vote?
Well, on this Labor Day weekend, this is a fantastic topic. I have to take us back to 1887. In 1887, one state, a relatively new state, Oregon, recognized Labor Day. By 1894, seven years later, there had been so much worker activity and workers struggled to organize until the country recognized Labor Day. And I look at what's happening, and I think this donor party, they don't select the candidates, but they definitely have an influence over the candidates, and that is they finance campaigns. The people should select the candidates. Like we saw that in Colorado, we saw that there was a major movement that just gave farm workers protection, their health and safety, and that didn't happen because of the big industrial farms. That happened because of the workers being organized. We see that in Massachusetts, the largest nurses strike in history is standing up right now, and it's up to. And they're having an impact, and it's in what is the county called? Worcester County. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. I think it's Worcester County. Well, that strike's going on. So we need to stand in solidarity with them. We saw what just happened in Texas with essential workers. Those workers stood united and have had an impact on essential workers. So this elite group certainly may contribute money to candidates. But if you notice, one group, for example, gave money to Hillary Clinton, and they gave the same amount of money to Donald Trump. So what these elite do is give everybody a little bit of money, and they give them all the same amount of money. They just want to have a place at the table no matter who is elected. So our power still remains in the electorate. I think that we need to educate ourselves and organize, because workers of the world knew in the 19th century that this country, if Congress made Labor Day, passed legislation creating a national Labor Day in 1894, after Oregon led the charge in 1887 and 32 states followed, that's what happens when people take over the micro politics and they develop a movement. We see that movement happening on the right now with this Alex group and this voter suppression bills and all these speaking points and the draft legislation that's provided to these individual legislatures in this republic across the land. So I think those rich people simply contribute to the campaigns because they want the folks to know their voice, know whom they are. Because quite often, people who run in local politics, they're not necessarily, it's a type of public service for many. And they're not mingling and running with the rich. And as Brother Haki said, on that Upper West Side, Upper East Side, are some of the wealthiest people in the world. And as for that one address on Park Avenue, they wanted to make themselves seem more elite than the old gentry. Because I've been in those apartments over there on Fifth Avenue. They're like mansions, two stories, elevators, servants' quarters, that kind of thing. Well, that's how the old gentry, the old rich live, and their townhomes, but they're not selling them. So what some developer did was came up with the idea to create 44 Park Avenue and did so. And it just goes to show you the super rich can be had too, because I don't think the resources and the materials and the structure of their building is as superior as the older buildings. And at a time of global warming, you don't see any geothermal floors, heated floors in those units. You don't see any solar panels. You don't see anything that puts them on the front page of environmental science and being chic, environmentally chic. They just paid a lot of money to someone who built a building. I feel they were suckers. And as far as what happens in American politics, again, these rich folks give equal money to anybody who's running. Right now we see in the city of New York, there is a mayoral election that will be coming up soon, and there's several candidates. And if you look at their campaign finance papers, if they look like they have a chance, then the rich folks are contributing to them. And again, most often for those that are just trying to have a voice at the table, they give the same amount to everyone. Now, there are sometimes politicians or certain interests that support one guy more than another, and they may really try to beef up his campaign and get him elected. But I think 44 Park Avenue was just a media hype, some media hype because they couldn't afford, and the people that own those that gold property in Manhattan are not selling. And Manhattan has so many vacancies and so many alleged luxury buildings. I saw where rents were dropping in New York City from $10,000 a month to $3,000. Really? Was it ever worth $10,000? So, you know, a lot of that is just hype. And those are the nouveau rich who live at one address, and they get to patronize each other. Would never want to be in their position. You know, I hope to live green, live in a place that's built with real wood, real plastic, not to be suffering the environmental hazards of living with laminate floors and committing environmentally unsound practices. Look, I understand they had bamboo floors up there. Look, they didn't even give them hardwood floors. They had to order certain features if they wanted them. Well, bamboo is sustainable in East Asia or in Asia, but it's certainly not sustainable in the United States, but it is cheap. So, again, this is Labor Day. I think we should stand solid with the laborers. Remember what happened in 1887 in Oregon and with workers being organized across the nation, what happened in 32 states. So that by the time 1893 rolled around, there was a solid bill on that hill that was supporting labor, and that Labor Day was formally recognized as a national holiday. So this is a great weekend for us working people, us working class people. And I believe the future is bright, and that education and education is the way to liberation. And I look at those workers up in Worcester, Mass, as I said, where the many people, workers, are standing in solidarity with the nurses who have the largest largest continuous nurses strike in the Commonwealth history. That's something to really think about. And again, in Colorado, where people were networking and organizing and gained some real labor protection for farm workers. And hey,
Sister Ellen,
the rich bought 31 units in a building that's not particularly significant architecturally, environmentally, or anything. They just spent a lot of money. Thank you, Brother
Sister Eleanor. When I look at this documentary, Park Avenue, Money, Power, and American Dream, again, to our listening audience, it's important for you to go and take a look at that documentary, because it gives you a critique of the overall political structure and functioning of this society in this country. And in essence, we're talking about capitalism. But when I look at this documentary, and I would like Haki to respond to this, and others can respond afterwards. When I look at this documentary, I thought when we talk about the donor club and the nature of these wealthy individuals among the elite, 1% among the 1%, what it showed to me and what it stated real clearly is that basically in order for a candidate just to be considered to get on the ballot, they need money. So they come to those who have the money. They even stated that without their endorsement, this party for any kind of people would know who going to be on the ballot. They would never be in position for anyone to vote for. So in essence, they talk about how they do choose the choices that you would have among to choose who to vote for. That's number one. Number two, it was clear to me when I look at that documentary, I view the rich and wealthy a bunch of pimps and hustlers, and the politicians as whores and prostitutes. They had down near 99.9% of all of these congressmen went and begged and needed their money to acquire the position that they are in. Now, when you're talking about capitalism and you're talking about power and influence, you tell me, when they talk about voting, do you think the politician truly vote in the interest of the people, or you vote according to who those he beholden to based upon the monies that they had to receive? Maybe I'm missing something here, Brother Haki. What is your take on that understanding when you saw that documentary?
Well, Brother Alfred, you're not missing anything. I'm going to go a step further. Keep in mind, there's an old experiment called Pavlov's dog. Remember that? In which, if you give them a certain food and reward them with that food, if you keep giving them that food, he would keep on performing. Well, politicians are the same, and the wealthy understand that. They understand that the more they invest in their attempts to gain access to office, they understand that the more policy they implement that empowers the wealthy, they understand they can anticipate more funds in the future, and so therefore they do it. It's a conditioning process. So let's not deceive ourselves in thinking that somehow that these politicians are altruistic, that they really give about the masses of people. That's simply not the case. But with respect to the donor party, the donor class, so when you talk about 1 or 2% of the population, only 90% of the GDP, 90% of the wealth of the country in the hands of if you talk about the top 10 for 1% of the population, about 200,000 individuals, These individuals on average give $5,000 store political contributions. Michael Lynn wrote a book entitled The American Nation, and this book specifically talks about how the wealthy people decide who enters positions of power, whether you're talking about Congress or the Senate on a federal and state level. So clearly, one of the things that I find ironic is that there have been several attempts, by Democratic lawmakers to implement, getting money out of politics. Strangely, neither Democratic or Republican politicians supported that bill. I wonder why they didn't support that bill. If you remove this money stipulation that you alluded to, Brother Africa, in terms of deciding who can run for office based upon money, then you open up the avenues to more progressive individuals to actually run for these offices to actually bring about real change. But that is precisely the point. If you open up this process to the rank and file, then you not only you run the problem of potentially exposing the system for what it is, but you actually get people in positions of power who are actually advocating for real change. And by virtue of having positions of power, they're in position to influence the masses of people to advocate for more change. And so therefore, people in positions of power understand it's not in their interest to form any kind of bill that's going to take money out of the political system. So let's be very, very clear. But just in terms of impact, when we talk about the influence of money, let's be very, very clear on something. When we talk about the influence of money, it exceeds the political whim. It exists throughout the entire of American structure, political structure. Particularly when we talk about, remember when we talk about critical race theory in 1619 Project? Now, these are projects specifically geared toward getting the people to understand the history of this country and to address some of those systematic wrongs that have permeated the society, for centuries. Well, guess who's been in opposition to the critical race theory in 1619 Project? They're very wealthy. Well, how do they express their resentment in terms of the critical race theory in 1619 Project? They fund who? Politicians. Politicians on the front line to advocate against critical race theory, 1619 Project. The power of money. Look at the media. When you talk about, particularly when you talk about Google and all of these telecommunications companies, you look at it in terms of how difficult it is to convey progressive ideas. The reason is very, very clear. That telecommunications understand that their vested interests are tied into working with people who have money. In order to make money, you work with people who got money. And so therefore, it's in their interest to play ball with the powerful. So therefore, powerful does not want progressive voices on telecommunication platforms, and so they do. They limit them and they elevate conservative voices. Is that a coincidence? No, it's the power of money. I don't know. It's not rocket science. It's very, 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 very clear. One of the things is when we talk about in terms of the role of money, let's understand something. One of the things the article bring out is a very, very good point. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, Haki. We can hear you. Go on. Go ahead.
My phone is acting crazy. Yeah, my phone is acting crazy. Okay, but in any event, so when we talk about in terms of the role, in terms of money, in terms of influence, policy, and society, one of the things that is very clear, this article points out, back in the 60s, all those journalists who actually talked about the plight of poverty, why poverty exists in America, and society's wealth in America, why poverty exists, those lawyers, those journalists were systematically eliminated. They brought in lawyers from Ivy League schools. Why would you bring in journalists from Ivy League schools? Simply because they understood, I believe people in the Ivy League schools understand the game. And so they understand that there's money to be made. And as a consequence, those people in positions of power or who run these media agencies, they actually increase the salaries. They literally increase the salaries threefold to make sure that these journalists have adequate salaries. The reason they did that is, one, is not only to buy the journalists, but to make sure that the journalists understand that as long as you play by our rules, the wealthy people's rules, as long as you play by their rules, then you can expect the easy street. You can expect relative ease in terms of your career, in terms of making money. And so that's precisely the role of money. That's what precisely what money does. And that's what we got to be understanding. As much as we would like to believe that these politicians are out here trying to advocate on behalf of the masses of people, the bottom line just doesn't exist. You got a few out here actually talking about saying some good things. Cori Bush is saying some good things. Alexander Ocasio-Cortez is saying some good things. But the bottom line is that the things that they say are negated, you know, by a party was totally indifferent to what they're saying, because they understand to embrace what they're saying is not in their interest. Their interest is to make money. It is very, very clear. It's very, very simple. And so if we think that we're going to vote and bring the most progressive people into political office and they're going to make a difference, the political system is not established that way. The only way conceivably you could do that, if the rank and file invested in particular leadership, and if they get provided, they have enough resources, they can make sure that they finance that person's candidacy, and hopefully that person gets into office. That person then becomes free to advocate truly what the masses of people really need. But the problem is that it's one of finances. When you factor in inflation in terms of what it is you want to campaign, it becomes extremely expensive. Media coverage is extremely expensive. They're not going to make it easy for you to have access to the media when you run in the candidacy. It's going to be expensive. So why do they do that? Because they want to limit the voices out there. And the voices that are heard will represent the very wealthiest in society. So clearly, let's be clear, let's be realistic about this and understand that we're talking about a system in place. And unless we eradicate or destroy or get rid of that system, then the bottom line is more of the same is going to happen into the future.
Okay, let's bring in Brother Anthony, and we're talking about this whole question of the role of those live in the area of Park Avenue up in Washington, D.C., the elite among the elite, and how they influence and control the political process and system. Brother Anthony, as you watch that documentary, the Park Avenue, talking about money, power, and American dream, talking about how the elite control financially and politically the politicians, when you look at that behavior, that relationship, one of the questions I raised earlier was, what can we do to make these people feel uncomfortable? How do we deal with that contradiction when you're talking about so-called democracy and voting, while on the other hand, your politicians are financially tied to those who donate to them? Your response, Brother Anthony, to this phenomenon.
The system has to be destroyed. And the system I'm talking about is capitalism, which allows this sort of thing to occur. But let's see, short of that, only a reform in a way, only changes in the way political campaigns are financed will end the monopoly that the wealthy have over political elected positions. And let's see, and one reform would be that to end private financing of campaigns. In other words, including the candidates themselves, they cannot. And to take an example from socialist Cuba, they have elections, but the candidates cannot use their own money to finance their campaigns. The campaigns are publicly are financed with government funds, and that levels the playing field. In other words, someone who's wealthier does not have an unfair advantage of someone who is poor financially. And it's only under this sort of arrangement that the playing field can be leveled, so that candidates can be chosen based upon their beliefs and their ability, not so much how many resources they command.
Okay, to our listening audience, thank you, Anthony. This is part three of Disruption, the theme Disruption, Control, and Power. One of the things you try to do on Africa on the Move is to provide your information so you can think and digital organization, so you can not only think clearly, but act in a way that you can bring about positive change. What we want to do as it relates to the third part, deal with deception, control, and power, we highlighted a documentary that we encourage you to go to YouTube that is titled, How the Elite Control the World, The Rich Getting Richer, The Upper Class and Money in America. Okay, we want you to go get a chance to check this out, but meanwhile, we're going to play this evening. Want you open up your ears, and once you get finished, we can have a dialogue on this particular documentary. So right now, we're going to play How the Elite Control the World, The Rich Getting Richer, The Upper Class, and Money in America. We want you to get a better understanding, in essence, of what is that you are fighting against, so you can have a better understanding of what you're fighting for. So sit back, take some notes, and we'll be right back with the discussion. We'd like to have your input as well by calling 323-679-0841. So let's listen to How the Elite Control the World.
Well, we have talked today about students beginning their careers. We've talked about correspondents ending their careers. We've talked about the names A.J. Liebling and I.F. Stone have come up. One of the things I most admire about the profession is it has allowed some people to say what they mean and to stand by it, to live by it. Louis Lapham, editor of Harper's, was described yesterday's New York Observer as America's favorite grouchy magazine editor. I don't think of him that way. I think of him as an iconoclast. I think of him as a trenchant observer, someone who says exactly what he means and says it extremely well, and someone who provokes me and sometimes elucidates, sometimes provokes. But I think that's the very best tradition of American journalism. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Louis Lapham.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. I see many friends in the room, and I'm sorry I didn't get the piece out of Mr. Frank. I thought I was going to come and talk to a very small lunch and tell old stories about the days when I was a foreign correspondent and so forth, but Bill persuaded me to talk about the new American ruling class, which is subject to which I, and how does journalism fit into the new order. So I'm not a Marxist and I'm not a revolutionary. I'm not even a grouch, but I know that the word class arouses suspicion and uneasiness in an American audience, and I have no objection to a ruling class. No country can exist without a ruling class. That was true in Rome in the first century. That was true in the United States in 1787. That was true in Britain at the zenith of empire, and it's true now. So the only question in my mind is what kind of a ruling class, what's the character, and what's its worth made to what specifications, and with what passions or objectives in mind. And it seems to me that the American ruling class or governing class or possessing class, whatever you want to call it, my favorite term for it is equestrian class, because that is an old Roman term. The rank was for sale for 400,000 sesterces in Rome in the first century AD, and the governing class in America is it's a rank that is for sale. That's also always been true in the United States. But something has happened to that class over the last 50 years, I think. I think it is no longer a specifically American class. I think it's lost its interest in politics, and I don't think it has much use for an intelligent press. You know, now will ask me, who are we talking about? And the figures vary, and numbers of other writers have written on this subject. Bill Greider's written about it, Kevin Phillips, Christopher Lash, Michael Lind. Essentially, what we're talking about is that 1 or 2% of the American population that owns 90% of the nation's wealth and 75% of its capital assets. It's an oligarchy. It's not a large percentage, but it's a fairly large absolute number. I mean, maybe we're talking about 2 million people, perhaps. Essentially, these are the people who write the laws, who write the news, who run the schools, direct the corporations, own the media, own the banks. The rich and the servants of the rich. Lind, Michael Lind, in his book that he published last summer called The American Nation, refers to what he calls the Donor Party. The Donor Party is the group of no more than 200,000 people in the United States who give political campaign gifts in excess of $5,000. To become a candidate, you must be first elected by the Donor Party. That is the beginning and end of the American democracy. It's 200,000 people. Because if you don't have money, you don't, unless you're Steve Forbes or Perot, you have no, you don't even appear on television. Another way of describing the oligarchy or the equestrian class would be to just think of the shoppers on Madison Avenue or Rodeo Drive or the residents of the zip code section in New York, New York 10021, which is this narrow golden rectangle in the city of Manhattan, where the annual income is something like $2 billion a year income within that one zip code section. Another way to think of it would be the way that the public broadcasting network thinks of it, which is, I did a book show on television for a couple of years for PBS, and there, the PBS number, which is like the Harper's number, for the total universe of Americans that makes the market for the trade list of the New York Times, books, for magazines like Harper's, The New Yorker, Foreign Affairs, for the documentaries that appear on PBS, for most of the leading policy journals and so forth, we're talking about no more than 2 million people, if that many. That's the whole universe. Now, the people that essentially live within that universe, run the schools, own the banks, write the laws, and so forth, it's the view from the box seats. And the first thing that's changed in the last 50 years is the sense of responsibility. I believe, maybe I'm a romantic, but I do believe that 50 years ago, this class felt some degree of responsibility toward the lower orders. There was a sense that privilege entailed obligation. The attitude was derived in part from the attitude of the British ruling class, the late part of the 19th century, from whom we, the Americans, picked up the white man's burden in the direction of Rudyard Kipling, who wrote that poem, as a matter of fact, as a campaign speech for Teddy Roosevelt. But that attitude is also confirmed by the American victories in World War II. And I happen to have been thinking a great deal about this subject lately because I am writing a book about the social and intellectual history of Yale University over the second half of the American century, 1950 to the year 2000. The American century, as you know, is a phrase coined by Henry Luce, Yale, 1919, former chairman of the Yale Daily News and so forth, and the whole sense of American empire, American primacy, American supremacy, American obligation is very much in place at Yale in the 1950s, which is when I was there as an undergraduate, And several of the professors in both the English department and the history department were recruiters for the CIA. The sense that of a noble mission of bringing the light to a darkened world, the careers was very much part of the milieu. And Yale then, as Yale now, is in the business of making the American equestrian class. That is why one pays $26,000-$27,000 a year to send a child to either Yale, Harvard, Princeton, or the other universities that do this sort of thing. The people in the 50s identified themselves with an American Commonwealth. There was an American ideal. There was an American idea. There was a sense of obligation. I don't think that the current kids, the ones that I know at New Haven, or our current oligarchy has the same feeling at all. I think that the members of the American equestrian class today incline to think of themselves as align themselves with an international economic order rather than an American Commonwealth. There's very little patriotism in this among the people that I'm talking about. They have more in common with their peers, their economic peers, in England, Japan, or Germany than they do with the run-of-the-mill Americans in Omaha or Sioux City. And you see it in the character of somebody like Richard Nixon, who was very much at home with the Shah of Iran or Ferdinand Marcos or Noriega. People of that, those are the kind of people that he liked, could talk to, understood, deep fear and hatred of the ordinary American citizen. Corporations, the American corporations today receive much, if not most, of their income from abroad. Coca-Cola now no longer has a domestic division. It's a world company, and so they're not thinking in terms of of an American nationalist economics. A lot of this is also obviously true of the movie industry, which without foreign sales cannot afford to pay the kinds of salaries they now pay. It's also true of our banking industries and airlines and so on. So it's an international economic world order. And this is very clear. I sound like Buchanan, but Buchanan is right in this. I don't think this is a matter of opinion. I think this is a matter of sheer statistics. You can see it with NAFTA. You can see it in any number of ways. I saw it most clearly the year that the Challenger exploded. The 6 months after the Challenger exploded, AT&T and GE were called to testify before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee because the Cold War was still going on, and AT&T and GE had decided to send up their newest satellite on a Soviet rocket. It was the only rocket going, and the Foreign Relations Committee took this very seriously and said, you can't do this, this is trading with the enemy and so on, this is our most sophisticated technology and so forth and so on. And the two corporations said, we really don't care what you think, Senator, it's not important, because this is about money. And if we don't send it up on the Russian rocket, we're going to lose to the French. We can't afford to lose to the French. And you could make the speech to, you know, your friend at the Council on Foreign Relations, but no and goodbye. Another way of looking at the increasing isolation of the American equestrian order is in the move to the suburbs. A lot of other people have written about that, but we now have a country that is becoming increasingly feudal in its organization. We have the United States spends $20 billion a year on public law enforcement. That includes all forms of public law enforcement: city, county, sheriffs, FBI, Justice Department, and so forth. We spend $40 billion on private law enforcement. Again, it's the retreat from the public realm, privatization of everything. The private is 50 years ago, the notion of the public sector, the public sphere, the public commonwealth would have connoted a good. Today, in most usages, the word public connotes filth, squalor, incompetence, bad housing, fool politicians, and leaking drains, and so forth. And the word private is associated with the clear trout streams of Colorado, and all good things flow from the private sector as opposed to the public sector. That is something that has happened in 50 years. Another way you see the withdrawing is the American sense of humor. 50 years ago, most of the jokes, or many of the jokes, were the have-nots making fun of the haves. This was the humor of Mencken. This was the humor of the movies of the 30s. This was the humor of the New Yorker in the 30s, and so on. Today, it's reversed. The humor is the haves making fun of the have-nots. It's the humor of the David Letterman show. It's the humor of P.J. O'Rourke. It's the period. It's the humor of the hip movies of Quentin Tarantino. I happen to find it very repellent, but nevertheless, it is the tone that's in place. Second thing that's happened in the last 50 years, and corollary to what I'm talking about, in terms of the character of the American equestrian class, is the absence of interest in history or politics. One would have expected, circa 1950, 1955, even as late as 1960, that the people who enjoyed economic privilege would also be interested in the history of the United States, interested in the intellectual content of the media, of newspapers. I went to work at the New York Herald Tribune in 1960, which was the paper then owned by John A. Whitney, a leading Republican presence in New York and on that wing of the Republican Party. And his ownership of the Tribune at the time was in the line of Pulitzer, who was the Democrat, or Greeley, who was a Republican, or even Colonel McCormick of the Chicago papers, who was extreme, what we would today call extreme right. But Whitney's interest was primarily a political one. He had a political idea. And the ownership of the papers reflected that. They no longer do. I mean, now you would not associate, the corporations that own the networks, or that own the Disney company, or whatever the big media syndicates are, with a political idea. I'd associate them with an economic idea, with the new international economic world order, yes, but with an idea that somehow politics mattered, I wouldn't think so. And you can see that in the newspapers this morning. The front page of the Times today talks about the money likely to flow to the Democrat and Republican candidates for the House in next November's election. And clearly the lines are the same lines as Duane Andreas, the head of ADM, who gives with the left hand to the Democrat and to the right hand with the Republican, because it really doesn't matter. There is only, in my view, and lots of other people's view. There's only one political party in the United States at the moment. And the point is power. The point is to be have connection, to have access to the committee or to the tax legislation or to the telecommunications bill. Or it has very little to do with ideas. That is, again, a change, I think, over the last 50 years. You see this at on the stage at Yale University. You no longer can study political history, American political history. There is something called cultural studies. So the telling of the American tale has been broken down into telling of the Black American tale, or the feminist American tale, or the ethnic Native American tale, and so forth and so on. And you can go through the entire. You can take as the there is no curriculum that went in the 60s, but in order to satisfy the requirement for late 18th century history in the United States, you can take it in domestic pewter, butter churns, the plight of women on the frontier, and so forth. All interesting subjects, but not a coherent historical view. All right. If I'm correct, then in the two points about the American equestrian class over the last 50 years, point one being the feeling of no responsibility toward the less fortunate, and two, the absence of interest in either history or politics as a passionate interest, then what then becomes the function of the press? And the parallels to me are very similar. When I first started working for the newspaper, my first job was as a newspaper reporter for the San Francisco Examiner in 1957, a Hearst newspaper, and I was the only Ivy League person in the entire place. To use the word journalist nobody used the word journalist. Only Englishmen and fops used the word journalist. Americans used the word reporter or newspaper man. Nobody was paid any money to speak of, and nobody expected to make any money. I mean, one did not go into newspaper reporting to become rich. One came in for, probably in my case, romantic ideas growing out of the Depression and out of the autobiographies of novelists on the order of John O'Hara and Ernest Hemingway, but the notion was to somehow get at the truth and tell a story. It's a romantic notion. But and we tended, as newspaper guys, to identify with the people in the bleachers, not with the people in the box seats. And that changed in the middle 60s. By 1967, the ranks of the newspaper, what was the newspaper business, begins to fill up with people from Harvard and Yale and Princeton. The salaries begin to go up to $300,000-$400,000 a year for television personalities. And the identification shifts from the crowd in the bleachers.
We welcome you back to Africa on the Move. You are listening to a clip of a documentary titled How the Elite Control the World, The Rich Getting Richer, The Upper Class and Money in America. Now, I think in terms of when we listen to this documentary, it raised one fundamental question, and the question is, who is or what is the new American ruling class? Now, you know, Malcolm once taught us that history is best to reward those who research. In the book, The Outer Wall, one of the first things they mention is you must know your enemy, which means that we must constantly know the changes that are taking place within our environment and during certain historical times and periods. So when we talk about this new American ruling class, it doesn't necessarily have the same behavior than maybe the class 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, and maybe not. But the position of the documentary is that when you look at this new American ruling class, one of the things you'll find out is that it has no respect for American history and politics. And I can sort of understand that because they know it's a bunch of bullshit. Number two, they talk about it has no compassion for the people and for the poor. None at all, and don't think they have no responsibility, would lead to when you analyze your enemy, it means that your enemy would be very ruthless. They also talk about other contradictions that we need to be aware of about this particular ruling class people. But one of the important issues is the issue of their interests. This illusion about a national boundary and identity of being American, it doesn't exist in that world. They understand that their interest lies in the interest of those who line themselves up with them economically. The capital elites of the very countries see themselves as one and not by the boundary of the country in which they live, which also means and will give you a sense of maybe how future decisions, political decisions will be made and played out in terms of how and where wars will be begin, where they will end, and who they will identify as your enemy. So those are just some of the contradictions, and one other contradiction they talk about, if you look at the so-called new American ruling elite, is they understand at this stage of time of capitalist development about privatization. It has no respect for public projects and welfare. And they are willing to invest $29 billion into the police, intelligence, military complex. So all about force to make it right. Now you create all of these ingredients of analyzing this present class of ruling people throughout. Now you have the equation of how do you deal with such a ruling class? And I will pose that question to my panelists right now. I'll start off with Brother Anthony. Brother Anthony, you heard a documentary. You heard somewhat of capitalization or summarization of some of the points that were raised in it. And your response to how do you deal with the so-called new American ruling class, and not just limited to America, but the ruling class elite period on a global basis? Brother Anthony, your response.
Okay. Some of the trends that the moderator laid out follow the trends in terms of capitalism. And the ruling, let's see, and one of the things that occurred in history, and this is where the U.S. Civil War becomes critical, is because it represented the triumph of the capitalist bourgeoisie over the slave owners. This was critical from an economic standpoint because it allowed the U.S. to emerge as a full-blown capitalist society, kind of like Germany. And it was somewhat different from the older ruling classes in some of the older countries like Britain and France and Italy or Spain for that matter. And one of the things that happened was an intensification of the industrialization process, which was led by Germany and the U.S. And what happened is that as capitalism intensified its development, it became imperialism. And imperialism represents the dominance of finance capital over industrial capital. And as the moderator pointed out during his presentation, today's capitalists do not respect political boundaries, which were drawn up to keep the various ruling elites from fighting against each other. You see an intensification of the organization of the ruling elite or the ruling bourgeoisie. They've become more united in terms of their effort to preserve and consolidate power. And also along with this, you see an intensification of the organization of the working class also. So as capitalism develops, it tears all the old political relationships asunder as it develops. And pretty soon you just have two classes, the haves and the have-nots, to put it in simplified terms. And so you have, as capitalism, develops into world imperialism, political boundaries become less important. It is economic boundaries and ideologies that become more important. And that is why the clash is against the workers and against socialism versus capitalism. That struggle is intensifying. And that's some of the things I took away from the presentation.
Thank you, Brother Anthony. Brother Haki, as we look at the new American ruling class, one of the things this document talk about is when you talk about corporations, you talk about ruling class, they realize that to make their money, it comes from abroad. So therefore, they have no allegiance to what takes place inside America. Now, looking at all these characteristics of the elite and the powerful, what do you surmise in terms of how to best deal with them, given these various characteristics and behavior? Because at this point in time, it's very clear that they understand they want global control, and they also understand that these illusions of being a Democrat and Republican and listening to these politicians, they take orders from them. Politicians don't give them order. So how do you deal? How would you propose to the people? How should we deal with this so-called new American ruling class, Brother Haki?
Yeah, well, first, Brother Africa, I think when you talk about in terms of how they derive the money, we got to be very, very careful about that. Clearly, they make money from international investments in terms of stocks and bonds abroad, and there's no question about that. But a much bigger way, a much more concise way in terms of making wealth is generated right here in the country. And that is namely when we talk about qualitative easing, and we talk about the government unilaterally putting up large sums of money. That money directly benefits the wealthy. And so therefore, you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to create jobs. You don't do anything. The money is guaranteed. Superimposed upon a situation where you have all kind of accounting practices, which makes it impossible for you not to pay taxes. So the bottom line is that the richer get richer exponentially, and we get poor and poorer, poorer and poorer. So clearly, Brother Africa, in terms of the money question, they have no problem. Even if the rest of the world didn't exist, they would still generate money simply because it's structured that way to make sure that the wealthy become wealthier and wealthier. But the question in terms of how do you deal with that, Brother Africa, this is a very complex question, because the bottom line is that, one of the things is that the ruling class, the so-called new ruling class, see the masses of people as an impediment. They see them as a bother. you know, often, you know, the thinking or the philosophy of Ayn Rand, you know, runs, you know, squarely in the minds of a lot of these people who are in positions of power. Ayn Rand, the philosopher out of Russia, position was very, very clear that to help people is morally deficient, that you don't help people, that is only a weak person will actually help another person. Or the notion that greed is good and that to trample over people is natural, that's an intelligent thing to do, and it's a moral thing to do. And if you don't trample over people, then you're not living up to your moral capacity. So you got this convoluted kind of logic that exists in the minds of these wealthy people, and so therefore they're doing what they do in terms of their benefits. In that context, because they see the masses of people who don't have money, who don't have capital, they see them as a pediment. The question for them is very, very simple. What do you do with all those people that you don't have any need for? Keep in mind, wealth can, we don't need labor to produce wealth anymore. That's done by a keystroke of a computer. The Federal Reserve prints up the money, you know, the money distributed, you know, to the wealthy, and that's that. And so, therefore, you don't need labor in terms of create. You know how to create anything. You know how to build anything, produce anything to create wealth. So for them, the question is that they're assured of wealth, but the bigger problem is which is what do you do with all these people who don't have access to wealth? What do you do with all these people who are drained, in their estimation, a drain on the economy? That is the bigger question. And the question is what are we going to do in terms of understanding that reality and preparing ourselves for the inevitable? Because we understand that these people in positions of power have a unique opportunity, unique ability by propaganda, to actually condition people to believe whatever they want them to believe. If they want people to believe that critical race theory is a bad thing, that somehow it's anti-white, you got a thousand of the population going to believe that. They're not going to investigate for themselves. They're going to simply believe because the media keeps telling them over and over again critical race theory is a bad thing. So clearly, you know, I think the onus is on the masses of people in terms of what our response will be. And specifically, when we talk about the African community, we got to be very, very clear on something. When we talk about in terms of any kind of carnage being unleashed on the populace, then we got to understand that African people fit squarely in that phenomenon, and we got to understand that. And as such, you know, that we're targeted, but not only historically, but because we're targeted economically, then we got to understand that we're in a very vulnerable position. And so it's incumbent upon us, you know, to organize to the maximum extent possible. We have to. We don't have any choice. Don't listen to those black conservatives who tell you everything is fine. Don't worry about it. It's all good. Just don't you know, be ignorant. Don't know anything about history. Don't know anything about policy. Don't know anything about economics. Just trust the system and everything's going to be all right. Well, we take that position, then the bottom line is that when upheaval arrives, you know, and when we talk about this kind of ensuing destruction, we got nobody to blame but ourselves. We say to people now, listen, this is the situation. This is an area. This is the economic reality. This is the political reality. This is what's happening. We're telling you now, we're telling you something now in hopes that you understand the necessity in terms of organization because you understand the seriousness of the situation that we're confronting, the situation that we're quickly arriving at. We do that in hope that people understand the reality. But if people, the position is that no, that propaganda has more of a hold on the way I think anybody else is saying it, particularly when it comes to progressive analysis, then any kind of destruction that we face as a result of not understanding what's clearly going on, then, you know, the bottom line is that we can only blame ourselves. You know, of course, you know, and I think that's the biggest onus. As far as the wealth is concerned, you know, they're going to do what they got to do. They're committed to power. And this notion that they came from England for economic freedoms, they didn't come from England for economic freedoms. They came from England to be just like the English. And that's precisely what they did. And so when the speaker talks about, on that clip, talks about a sense of responsibility of the wealthy have declined, I disagree. The wealthy have never had a responsibility to the poor people. In fact, one of the things, when you talk about the 13 colonies, one of the things they implemented was a Poor Relief Act. The Poor Relief Act was simply a psychological ploy to compel or coerce labor into working. What they did was to simply, people who were infirm, people who were crippled, who were for whatever reason mentally incapacitated, or people who had various kind of, or cancer, whatever, those kind of people received a little bit of assistance, you know, from the state to meet their physiological needs. Just enough, that where they continue to suffer so the laborers could see that even though these people were infirm, they were suffering, they were sick, even though there were no second predicament, the response from the wealthy was that we're only going to do the bare minimum. It's sort of like when you think about wealth out today. They give the people $100, $200 a month and tell them, you know, you got a mother and a child or two children, one or two children, and they say live on it. And the way they are treated is it's an incentive. At least they think it provides an incentive for others, you know, not to be on welfare because they see the horrible treatment that the people on welfare receive. The same thing was implemented back in the 16th century. So nothing has changed. So this notion that, in fact, the sense of responsibility among the wealth has actually declined, it never existed. It never really existed. And so, you know, the point is that, you know, Brother Africa, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, we have to wake up and realize what the reality is. And if we don't wake up what the reality is, any price that we pay is a consequence of our inaction. So that's just the bottom line. I'll close with that.
Brother Haki, you made an excellent point of emphasizing again, history is best to reward those who research. We thank you. Going to our sister Eleanor. Sister Eleanor, the new elite and wealthy view the people as them, as the enemy. They have designed this capitalist system in which they see the people as the enemy. Mm-hmm. What would you propose in terms of how should we deal with this so-called new elite? What's your response, Sister Eleanor?
Well, Brother Africa, I'd like to just go back previously to the Park Avenue conversation. I was unable to pick up the article, so what I did was research the construction of the building, and I found that the building wasn't green, it wasn't progressive, it wasn't any of these things. So these aren't progressive people. These are not people that want to be the vanguard, that want to have the best of everything. They're just filthy rich. In reference to the last lecture or that we listened to, I found it very interesting, and there has become, with global imperialism on the rise in the last 50 years, we've seen where the super elite simply want to be with each other, know each other, and experience each other. But I found it interesting how some of this started in Germany, because the whole idea of race theory started out in the mid-19th century in Germany. Before this, before then, the world didn't have all these racial categories. And when it first started, it was interesting that Slavics and Irish people weren't considered to be a part of the elite white, and how America changed the world by allowing Irish men, property owners, to vote in the United States, and how it changed Irish history, the history of Ireland forever. But the history, the Irish people have always stood in solidarity with the African American liberation struggle. But no, these people don't have the political and social consciousness to know that every human being matters, and they don't know where genius comes from. They don't know where goodness comes from. And certainly, just because you're a trillionaire doesn't mean that you are contributing to the advancement of humankind. And these people being elitist are just that. And they are not the friends of the working class. Obviously, they're not contributing to organizing labor. They're not contributing to addressing the issue of global warming. And it was interesting that the Ivy Leagues for them wasn't a place where they necessarily went for an education. Many of the world's richest people didn't attend Harvard or Yale or Princeton. or if they did, they may have not completed. And, you know, so there's some, look at Bill Gates, look at some of these people. They're obviously have advanced their interests and have focused on their work. And this new social media and technology and microcomputers have changed the world and created a whole new ruling class. But as Brother Hakeem said, these people are not the friends of the working class, nor do they have the interests of the planet at heart or the well-being of anyone other than themselves. And that's why they're the 1%. And I mean it with a bit of sarcasm, meaning rather than they may be the wealthiest, but they're also the most backwards in their failure to embrace humankind and to be concerned about advancements in terms of education, health, science, and addressing issues like food insecurity, housing insecurity. It's ridiculous. And when I looked at that 44 Park Avenue, I just knew they had money to spend. I'm sorry I couldn't see the video for whatever reason, as I told you, Brother Africa. But in terms of this last brother, these Ivy League seems to be where they recruit the workers, the elite workers, the future CIA officers and these kind of folks. But they're certainly not necessarily sending the children, or their children aren't necessarily being successful in the Ivies. But it's a place for recruitment. They're not concerned with information and the distribution of facts and science and true journalism. These things have changed. I really think that that was solidified in the 1980s with what many people call the Reagan Revolution. Maybe President Reagan thought that he was here to represent the super elite, and the super elite do not have the interests of the people at heart. They do not have the interests of the masses, and they are not a friend to Mother Earth, and I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Sister Eleanor. Brother Moses, give me your take on what do you take from this particular documentary as it relates to the elite and how they are controlling the world. Brother Moses.
Yeah, Brother.
Hi.
Did not overcome the people's power, but it's possible for organizations. That's what we need to focus our attention on the issues, the needs of the working class, and organize in an independent party that's in the interest of the working class. So just we have to get ideologically at least on one accord in terms of where we're coming from and where we're going. And obviously they have money. That's what they got. They got finance capital. They can pay people to shoot people. They can do all kinds of things with that finance capital. And we have to be aware of that. But to organize people is more powerful. Ain't no power like the power of the people. And so that's what we need to focus on. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Moses. Right now, you listen to Africa on the Move. What we're going to do is we're going to take a rupture and a break. And when we come back, we're going to be closing out. We're going to have our political panel analysts give us their final thought on Part 3, Deception, Control, and Power. We'll be right back. This is Africa on the Move.
here in chains, living in pain. Today is the same, and nothing ever changes. Hung by a noose, can't tell the truth, filled with abuse, and everywhere there's danger. How long can this go on? When will the light I see? I know I must be strong to last through my journey, yes, to last through my journey, yes. Time will arrive when we must decide to get off the ride and stop going through these changes. We must prepare and learn how to care, for soon we'll be there where our lives won't be in danger. And when the light is clear, oh how beautiful I will be to know that I've been here and made it through my journey, yeah, and made it through my journey, yeah, 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 made it through my journey, made it through my journey.
Hello, Reno. A bloodline across the waters, from Benin to Salvador Bahia. A scar across the face of the earth. Pellerino, the place they brought the Africans, the place where they tried to make them slaves. Pellerino! You can feel the whip, hear the cries, and see the blood in the red clay. The clay that holds the stones together is African. And each stone is a bone from a people called slaves. Pellerino was the place where death came to dwell. His neighbors did not complain, for he was a way out. From the cold gray cobblestone streets to the lifeless cathedrals, tall walls of demons called angels, haunted visions of white faces crucifying Jesus again and again. But in the sacrifice of this blood, of this dance with death, comes life more rich, more pure, more alive, where death spent many lonely nights pacing the floors of his funeral parlor, waiting for someone to die. Pellerino, a French word called the place of torture, became a place of strength, a place where faces of white saints became faces of black gods, where haunted visions and demons became healing visionaries and orishas from the motherland. And Jesus rejoined his kinfolk and was reborn and baptized in the sound of sensual skin turned up to dance, to inspire a fire like the sun, pronouncing his presence. Pellerino was the tongue of the flame, licking the eyes of those who have tried to remain blind, shining a light on a spirit that would not be denied. No, the chains did not break the spirit, did not enslave the music of my soul, did not shackle the will of my freedom, did not tarnish the glow of my gold. And all the Pellerinos in Africa, in Europe, in North and South America cannot destroy the majesty of my people, the love of my people, shining like the sun everywhere we go. Everywhere we go. When the light is clear, oh how beautiful I will be to know that I've been here and made it through my journey. Yeah, and made it through my journey. Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. My journey. Yeah, 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 yeah.
This is Africa on the Move. This is the voice of Brother Africa. We are closing out on part three, Deception, Control, and Power. Before we go through our final thoughts tonight with our political panelists, we would like to make a couple of announcements to our listening audience and to the world that recently today we received an alert that there has been maybe a coup taking place in the country of Guinea, in Conakry. President Alpha Conde is now under the control of the military. We would like to find out more about that because what goes on in Africa definitely impacts our world no matter where we are. So we hope to find out a little more about this and maybe next week share an update on this recent maybe coup that has taken place in Guinea. Also, we'd like to remind you, the listening audience, to come and join African Wellness Association. Under the banner of the African Wellness Association and other organizations, as we can begin to organize our Black History Education Tour and Culture Tour to Cuba trip from December 27th to February 3rd, 2022. Please come and join us and email us if you have interest. You can do that by emailing AfricanAwarenessAssociation2@gmail.com. All lowercase, all spelled out together. AfricanAwarenessAssociation2@gmail.com. Or email AfricaOnTheMove2@gmail. And we'll make sure that information will get to that organization. Those are our announcements. And we just want to remind you that this program comes on every Sunday from 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Please spread the word that they can be a part of this beautiful discussion as relates to what's going on with our people in the world, and also to be a platform where you can share your views and your perspective so we can learn collectively. This is what it's all about. So join us every Sunday at 7 p.m. We need your support. So please, at least help us be our audience. By the end of the next year, we want to have at least 1 million listeners, and we know we can do that with your support. So right now, on the 5th day of September 2021, we can close out on that segment, Part 3, dealing with deception, control, and power, and we'll get our final thoughts from our political panelists and analysts. We'll go back to our Brother Moses, and Brother Moses, your final thoughts, please.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we know that the lies and propaganda of the few cannot last forever. We know that the people united will not. We know that truth will prevail eventually. So we must rely on our lines and stand on truth and rely on that to win over our friends and, self-Christian is necessary in any struggle. And so we need to adhere to that.
It's been an enjoyable show. Thank you. There we go to Sister Eleanor. Sister Eleanor, your final thoughts for today's program.
Well, united, the people will never be defeated, and I stand in solidarity with the nurses' strike in Worcester, Massachusetts, and this is the largest nursing strike in the Commonwealth's history. And congratulations to the people in Colorado this Labor Day for winning protections for the farm workers. And we stand, and to the workers in Texas, in a small county in Texas that are making headway on essential workers' rights, the people who work in grocery stores and these kind of things. And we have to educate ourselves, educate the youth, give them the tools necessary to be able to provide essential services for themselves, such as housing security, to eliminate food insecurity, to improve health conditions, in the United States and the world, and to remember that Labor Day was not given to us by Congress and the bourgeoisie's interest in workers, but it was something that the workers took because they were organizing all over the country where they stood in solidarity, not only with their neighbors, but with brothers and sisters in every state. And we saw positive change, and we can do it now. And remember that, as Brother Akeem said, of course, like we see some progressive politicians, but we need others. And as long as the 200,000 donors are given equally to everyone, that lets me know that there's a concern that the electorate does have power and that they can have an impact at the polls. And we need to see legislative change or get these people out of office, because if not, we may end up saying in a few years, gee, the weather was really cool. It was a really beautiful weather we had in 2021. And wow, that pandemic wasn't that bad when you look at the next one. So with that, you, Brother Africa, for allowing me to participate, and I wish all the other analysts a wonderful Labor Day. Just to stand united and remember that when we have the tools as workers to advance worker rights through education and cultural solidarity, we will become the rulers of the world. Thank you, and may we move closer and closer to environmental justice every day, social and environmental justice every day. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan Alador, for your contribution to today's program. Every now I'm bringing Brother Haki. Brother Haki, your final thoughts for tonight.
Well, Brother Africa, it seems to me the writing is on the wall. There's a pervasiveness of a certain philosophy among capitalists which says that individualism is the norm, which says compassion is a sign of weakness, or the poor people are considered parasites, and capitalism is moral. Now, given this perception among those who are powerful, clearly they don't have a high degree of concern for the plight of our poor people in society. When I think back to 2012 and the Path to Prosperity bill that was passed by Congress, a very interesting bill. The bill advocated $10 trillion tax cuts for the rich, and at the same token, slashing the capital gains by 15% to 15%. Now, capital gains is simply taxes on assets as they increase in value. So if I got large hectares of land, and the assessment goes up, the asset tax price goes up, I pay considerably less taxes on it, even though the value of my land continues to go up. So it's very, very interesting in terms of this willingness in terms to accommodate those who are very, very powerful. But more importantly, when you talk about $10 trillion in cuts for wealthy people, inevitably, in order to accommodate those cuts, you have to cut spending also. When government cuts spending, who's hurt by that the most? It is poor people. Poor people are hurt by the most. The mere fact that it doesn't resonate with the capitalists, that the fact that these cuts are going to hurt poor people immensely, the mere fact that they don't care speaks volumes in terms of, you know, their inner thoughts, in terms of how they actually feel about poor people. And if that's any indication that poor lives are superfluous or that they're unimportant, then if that is the guiding philosophy, then it seems to me that poor people have an obligation for themselves, to at least organize, to begin to stand up, and again, to create those kind of institutions in the community that tends to empower. Because without that empowerment, the reality is that a lot of things that we come to expect from government, those things are not forthcoming, simply because the bottom line is when you have a situation where the government routinely prints up money to benefit the most wealthy people in society, it means that the availability of money for those people for services that impact the poor are simply not available. So as a consequence, you see a vast decrease in terms of the amount of kind of money allocated to assist poor people in society. So despite the homelessness, despite the lack of health care, despite the joblessness, despite all those problems that adversely impact poor people, those services are being cut. And so given that reality, in capitalist mind, these people, who are paying the price for these cuts, in their minds, their pain really doesn't matter. If their pain doesn't really matter, then what does that mean in terms of their lives? Does their lives matter? I would venture to say that if the pain of poor people doesn't matter to the capitalists, then certainly your life doesn't matter. In fact, if your life was ended, as far as the capitalist is concerned, that would be a benefit, because that's one less person to potentially soak up any resources that may come their way. So clearly, we got some real problems, and no matter how we cut it, no matter how we pretend everything is fine, no matter how much we want to believe that the government is omnipotent, that is everywhere, that is possible, is capable of resolving all our problems, the bottom line, a lot of problems we face are the direct result of government policy. And so given that reality, then poor people have to understand that, listen, the writing's on the wall. If we don't grasp that simple reality, the bottom line is that we'll be ill-prepared for whatever comes down the road. And it's a very, very sad commentary, and it's something I don't take any solace in talking about. I would like to not talk about it at all, but if I did, I would be remiss not to warn people that this stuff is on the way. I mean, and it's not hyperbole. It's not an exaggeration to say when we talk about these people on January 6th going to the Capitol to raise hell under the guise that their man lost the election, or the notion that somehow that their man could make things great for white people, we got to understand what the implication means for African people and the poor people in the society. And if we haven't glimpsed that, if we don't understand the fundamental reality in terms of that kind of mindset that exists in society, and we're talking about over 73 million people in the society, which is close to half of the population. If we don't understand that fundamental, or at least the voting population, if we don't understand that fundamental reality, then we're in big, big trouble. And I certainly hope that people begin to grasp the seriousness of the situation, as it unfolds. But anyway, Brother Africa, as always, I encourage people to unravel the matrix. That is key. With all the changes taking place in society, we must begin to understand. We must make a concerted effort to read as much as we possibly can, to grasp, to get with other people, to compare notes, to talk about this stuff, and to understand precisely what's happening, the implications for us as a people. Having said that, Brother Africa, I will close, and you have a good night.
Good night to you, Brother Haki. You have a good night. And to Brother Anthony, your final thoughts for tonight. Brother Anthony.
Yes. My final thought for tonight is that we must, as Nkrumah said, we must organize as we never have before. We must intensify level of organization and political organization, because the resources of the earth are getting scarcer, and as they get scarcer, the focus is going to the focus on Africa is going to increase. So we must organize ourselves in order to liberate our motherland and build one unified socialist Africa. That is the only solution to the problems that Africans face worldwide. And to learn more about Pan-Africanism and the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC, please visit our website, www.a-aprp-gc.org. www.thewordofgod.org.
And we'd like to thank you as well, Brother Anthony, for your contribution to today's program and to all our friends, supporters, and listening audience. We'd like to thank you as well and remind you that you can listen to this program every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Please spread the word. This year coming up, we want to set a goal. We want to reach at least 1 million Africans and progressive brothers and sisters throughout the world. And we can't do this without your support. We also want to remind you again, too, to come and help join us as we go to our Black History, Education, and Culture Tour to Cuba from December 27th to January 3rd under the banner of the African Awareness Association as well as with other local organizations. And last but not least, we just want to remind you that we may not give you what you want, but we'll do the best we can to give you what you need. And we know that without information, you cannot think. And without organization, you cannot think clearly. We encourage you that if you love your people, you want to help your people, want to make your proper contribution, there's only one way you can do that. That is to be through an organization. So I encourage you to join an organization that is fighting for the liberation of your people. If you find one that doesn't desire you to do things that you think it need to be doing, then you have the responsibility to create one yourself. Until next time, if you love Mother Africa, you'll work for Mother Africa. We strive always to go forward ever, backwards never. And right today, if I had all the money in the world, this is what I would do with it.
Wondering. brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and kiss here today. Picket line and picket sign, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Oh, what's going on? Oh,
right now. Right now.
Since it's all down here.
Nobody knows what to say.
institution, a noble piece of paper with free society. The struggle, but they died in vain. And now democracy is a ragtime on the corner, a hoping for some rain. It's looking like he's a hoping, hoping for some rain. And
if you think of the Middle East in this modern time, you can't help but say the word Palestine. People there have lost their land. Some have lost their home. They live in other countries, their freedom almost gone. Palestine,
Palestine
needs her freedom. Palestine,
Palestine
needs our love,
needs our love.
Palestine,
Palestine
needs her freedom. Palestine,
Palestine
needs our love.
Needs our love.
There seems to be no answer to give us the reason why people cannot live, so no one has to die. We've got to take a stand for freedom, take a stand for truth, take a stand for justice. That's what we've got to do, 'cause Palestine,
Palestine
needs her freedom. Palestine,
Palestine
needs our love,
needs
our love. Palestine,
Palestine
needs her freedom.
Palestine,
Palestine needs our love.
Is my king, is my one, yes, he's my father, yes,
He's my son, so I can talk to him, 'cause he understands everything I go through and everything I am. He's my support system, I can't live without him. The best thing since sliced bread is his kiss, his hugs, his lips, his touch. And I just want the whole world to know about my
black brother. I love you and I'll never try to hurt you. I want you to know that I'm here for you forever too. 'Cause you're my black brother, strong brother, and there is no one above you. I want you to know that I'm here for you forever too.
He's misunderstood. Some say that he's up to no good around the neighborhood. Well, for your information, a lot of my brothers got education. Now check it, you got your Wall Street brother, your blue collar brother, you're down for whatever, chilling on the corner brother, your talented brother. And to every one of y'all behind bars, you know that Angie loves you. Oh, my
black brother,
No.
Never try to hurt you.